From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
I don't expect someone to greenlight a $150 million movie because I'm funny in a room or I'm a good dinner guest.
Filmmaker Guillermo del Toro on dealing with the realities of the movie business, managing worry, and the lessons he's learned from failure. But first, on an all-new Hollywood News Banter, Warner Brothers hits a cold spell. I am joined by my fellow banterer, Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine, coming to us from Hawaii, which is so not fair. Aloha, Mike.
Aloha. Do I have to come back?
Eventually, I fear that you will. But you're gamely ready to banter from a very nice place, so let's get to it. Warner Brothers, topic A, you know, a lot of eyes were on the Tom Cruise movie Edge of Tomorrow, which was not tracking well, even though it was very well reviewed. And indeed, as anticipated, it did not perform well. And this has led to an appraisal of what is going on at Warner Brothers, which is in for an unaccustomed turn in the barrel, it looks like.
Yeah, a string of stinkers. I mean, you look at the Adam Sandler movie Blended a few weeks ago, also did terribly. Tom Cruise, I mean, once upon a time a superstar, but his $178 million movie only made about $28 million at the box office in week one. And coming up next, Jersey Boys is tracking pretty poorly as well. It looks to be the latest musical-turned-movie bomb. So it's tough times, and there's not a lot in the cupboard over the next few months and even next year for Warner Brothers.
It's been about a year since Jeff Robinoff was sort of ushered out or ushered himself out as head of the studio. And I think it really raises an interesting question. I mean, Jeff Robinoff is kind of an old school studio executive, could do all these functions very hands-on in things like, you know, fixing a movie if it wasn't working. He held Gravity for 8 months because he felt like it needed work and he wanted that release date. So fixing a movie or getting it through production, picking a release date, setting a marketing strategy. I mean, they have a sort of committee now of Sue Kroll marketing, Greg Silverman, the head of production, and Toby Emmerich, who runs the New Line label, doing that job that Jeff Robinoff used to do. And the question that this raises to me, in part, is, you know, is a committee better than or capable of even being as good as one person with a very clear vision?
Well, Kim, I'll answer that for you. No, it's not better. We've seen this time and time again. You know, dictatorships always win the day. I always use CBS and Leslie Moonves as the perfect example. That's a dictatorship, and that company works like a well-oiled machine. When you've got a three-headed monster like they do at Warner Brothers now, all reporting to Kevin Sugihara, the CEO, you've got different agendas. You've got different sides of the company sort of doing different things. And how you sort of work together and come up with a cohesive vision, it's virtually impossible. Possible, and that's what we're seeing now.
And the other thing I've seen, you know, is that I'm told by people around town that Warner's is very upfront, and I talked to Greg Silverman about it. They are very upfront. They want every movie to have huge box office potential, and the reputation is they're willing to spend very big to get that. Greg Silverman said, well, we're willing to spend less if we think it can be huge, and that's kind of, you know, a rare phenomenon. But when you do that, you can really get hurt, and that is what has happened with Tom Cruise movie and is likely possibly to happen with this Wachowski siblings movie, Jupiter Ascending, moved out of summer and into February 2015. Not exactly a vote of great confidence, despite the fact that they claim this is all about, you know, doing special effects work.
Yeah. No, I'm worried about that. And you know, if there's any sleeper coming down the pike, it might be the New Line movie Tammy that Melissa McCarthy stars in. I mean, she's a star, and seen some of the promos so far. It looks funny. It looks like if you liked Bridesmaids, you might like Tammy. So we'll see if that does anything.
Yes, that's one of the smaller movies with a lesser budget.
Yeah, but that's, I think, the only one that, you know, has potential coming down the pike.
Until
2016,
right.
When you got the Lego movie sequel, you've got Zack Snyder's Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice. Suddenly, some of the big franchises that conceivably are still working come, and maybe the pendulum swings back the other way.
Yeah, I mean, one of the issues here is that Harry Potter is gone. Chris Nolan's Dark Knight movies are gone. Those are all played out. So you need to replenish, and that they're hoping Zack Snyder will do that with the Batman and Justice League generally. They're hoping that J.K. Rowling will help out but with this Harry Potter spinoff without Harry Potter, which seems like a pretty good bet, you know, the Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. But it's going to be a while, and it's unaccustomed, as I said, for Warner Brothers to find itself in this position. And meanwhile, again at Time Warner, Amazon, you know, Amazon is not a Time Warner company. Amazon is Amazon. But Amazon has been much publicized, has been in a battle with Hachette over pricing of books. And this has affected authors like Malcolm Gladwell and Stephen Colbert, which is, you know, he's made a big fuss because they do not want to make it easy for you to buy books from Hachette because Hachette is not meeting Amazon's terms. And now they're taking on Warner Brothers.
Yeah, this is the Amazon that we always expected and feared would come to play. And as they become even more of a monopoly, they are playing hardball. And they're playing hardball with big folks like Warner Brothers. And the fact is, they're refusing pre-orders for Time Warner movies, including The Lego Movie, which probably should be number one on their list of pre-orders. But get this, Kim, it's languishing at number 18,183, according to the New York Times, which really that pre-order, again, should be in the top 10. But because they're refusing this and people are having to make a go around to actually find the movie, it's interesting.
Yeah, if ever there's a title that people want to buy, it's a kid's title, and Lego is a huge kid's title. And of course, people want to buy it, and they're not going to be able to buy it with Amazon. And I have to say, Amazon to me, you know, I mean, this has been written about by many people. They are making very limited statements, basically have confined themselves to a comment about Hachette saying it's common to be in a negotiation with a supplier. But people are calling for boycotts. People are getting really mad about this. The thing that kind of struck me as a blow from the movie standpoint was in the New York Times article reporting it, it said it's unlikely that the trouble with the Lego movie will cause as much outcry because people don't care about DVDs. But I think that's well, a miscalculation when it comes to the Lego movie.
Yeah, well, I think in that case, at least, you still have major consumer outlets like Target and Walmart selling sort of the lion's share of DVDs. So it isn't as big a deal as trying to find an obscure Hachette title on Amazon and not finding it or having to wait an extra 4 weeks for it to come to your doorstep. So this is still much more of a chilling effect for book publishers than it is for DVD manufacturers and distributors. But it's still, again, a reminder that this is the world we live in now as DVD shops go away, as bookstores go away, and Amazon is truly, quote-unquote, the everything store, as they like to say, that we're going to run into more of these disputes between distributors and Amazon.
Mahalo, Mike.
I'll see you soon.
That's Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. And you can keep up with us on Facebook at KCRW's The Business. Coming up next, filmmaker Guillermo del Toro. On July 13th, the FX cable channel will premiere a new vampire horror series, The Strain. It's based on a novel trilogy written by Guillermo del Toro and Chuck Hogan. Today, we revisit a conversation with del Toro from last summer when his apocalypse movie, Pacific Rim, was just hitting theaters.
I need to access a kaiju brain. Completely intact.
No. The skull plate is so dense that by the time you drill into it...
The brain's rotted away, but I'm talking about the secondary brain. Now, we both know that the kaiju are so large they need two brains to move around like a dinosaur. I want to get my hands on that.
Pacific Rim reportedly cost $190 million and didn't fare that well in the U.S. Overseas audiences pushed the worldwide gross to $411 million, but the project still was not the hoped-for hit for its backers, Warner Brothers and Legendary. Nonetheless, del Toro has been working on a script for a sequel, though Legendary hasn't committed to finance it. Del Toro has a passionate following for his original and eclectic work, from the comic horror Hellboy movies to the Spanish-language arthouse fantasy Pan's Labyrinth. He was executive producer on DreamWorks Animation's Puss in Boots, Kung Fu Panda 2, and Rise of the Guardians. Until he made Pacific Rim, del Toro hadn't directed a movie since Hellboy 2 in 2008. Not that he didn't try. He spent 2 years preparing to direct The Hobbit, but left the project when it seemed indefinitely stalled. He spent a year preparing the adventure horror film At the Mountains of Madness, but Universal pulled the plug. Meanwhile, Rise of the Guardians fared poorly at the box office, leading DreamWorks Animation to take a loss of $87 million. Pacific Rim was by far the most expensive film that del Toro had ever directed, and when we talked last summer, it wasn't clear that that movie would do well either.
Marketing, polling, all this stuff is not my field of expertise, so I'm nervous about that to a point, but I've seen the movie now. About eight times. With an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy. So, you know, yes, I'm watchful, but I am not. I go through seas of calm and acute episodes of anxiety, you know, but I'm not constantly anxious about it.
Because there's been so much. I mean, you're coming right off the heels of The Lone Ranger, mm-hmm. spectacular yeah. bomb. And the movies have become, I don't know, did you feel that you needed to make this large movie to be in the Hollywood game of today, or did you just want to make it this movie?
Oh, without a doubt, I just wanted to make this movie. You know, I have all my life, all my career has been driven by purely idiosyncratic emotions. I only do things I completely believe in. I say no to things I don't. Big, gigantic things. Coming out of The Hobbit, I was offered one of the biggest movies of the last 3 years. And I said, I'm not the guy to do it. I don't understand the mythology behind it. And I said, no.
You're not going to tell us what that
is? No, I'm not. Okay. I mean, it's that is etiquette. You know, but I really will say this. The only chance I have of having peace as a storyteller is tell the stories I do care about. And I don't care if the budget is gigantic or small. I'm happy. The next project I'm doing right now is a pilot for FX, for The Strain, the series based
on
my
book. Right, the television show.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I have 20 days to shoot it. You know, so Pacific Rim was 103 days. So I'm comfortable going from one size or one schedule to another very, very much.
You hadn't directed a film for some years, though.
Yeah.
It's been since you said Hellboy 2.
5 years, yeah.
5 years.
Yeah.
So did you feel like, well, I need to get back and direct a film? Or, but, I mean, obviously some of that time was consumed, I guess, with Hobbit.
Hobbit was 2 years, and then 1 year was consumed with parallel preparation of Mountains of Madness and Pacific Rim at the same time. There was always the understanding that if Mountains didn't happen or if the schedule cleared, I would do Pacific Rim. And that's 3 years right there. And then the 3 years of Pacific Rim, one of which overlaps, that's the 5 years. It's difficult to embark in a project of a big size and then it not happening. It takes a chunk away.
Yeah, you've been through quite a lot of that in the last few years.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And I don't want to go into the whole saga of The Hobbit, mm-hmm. but I am curious about the effect of it. When you invested so deeply, I just was reading the New Yorker article where they talked about your designs, and it wasn't like you had just flirted with The Hobbit. You were in New Zealand.
I moved my whole family. I bought two homes. We stayed there full 2 years. What it is I had the best time of my life living in Wellington.
It's great there.
It's an amazing town, one of the most beautiful countries in the world, great people. And it was just time to make a decision. I put a couple of thresholds and I said, if we cross them and everything is not resolved and I can get a green light, I'll leave. And I don't look back. I don't look back and say, oh, it got green lit, it got made. I don't look back. I'm blessed with a very, very disproportionately small rearview mirror.
A small rearview mirror.
Yeah.
But creatively, did you feel like, I mean, I don't know, I'm hardly going to analogize writing a story to making a film, but, mm-hmm. you know, if I write a difficult story,
yes.
I'm kind of depleted for a while, and I feel like I pay. I have to sit there.
I don't sit there. I am incapable of sitting there. I mean, I just finished Pacific Rim. It was a gigantic adventure. It was a huge endeavor. I'm taking 7 days off and into the pre-production of The Strain. I'm already in pre-production.
Seven days off.
That's all I can manage. I love working. I am socially inept, and I am a very strange
creature.
You seem
very nice right now.
Well, no, yeah, but I'm not a guy. I fit in what I do. Making movies is my life, and my family travels with me. We are a circus family. They married a strange circus performer. They travel with me. We live that life, and that's it actually fits in the cinema.
Pragmatically speaking, how many are in that party, and what about your kids are in school, right?
Yeah, my daughters are 12 and 17. So the 17-year-old is on the verge of saying, I'm not traveling anymore, which is perfectly legitimate, and we'll find a solution. And I actually tried to solve it to their favor, to go to cities they want to live in, and trying to accommodate them living near a park or whatever they want. I tried to do it. But it is a nomadic life.
And the kid moves from school to school, you take a tutor with you?
Yeah. When I was a kid, I went to Europe the first time in my 20s. And my daughters have lived in Prague, Budapest, UK, Madrid. One of them, the older one, speaks three or four languages. So, you know, every family has idiosyncrasies. I think family is by nature imperfect. You know, it's an imperfect little society. But if there's love, everything's good.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with filmmaker Guillermo del Toro. As he was preparing to make Pacific Rim, he was also hoping to launch another project based on the H.P. Lovecraft horror novella At the Mountains of Madness. Despite having Tom Cruise attached to star and James Cameron producing, Universal pulled the plug before production got underway. The issue was Del Toro's insistence on an R rating. With a budget of $150 million, that choice would limit the film's potential box office performance.
I do understand the reasons. So from a business point of view, I actually understand and I can see that point of view. It still was difficult for me. But, you know, although I do not follow the inside baseball sport of the business, I do know that business decisions are business decisions. And I don't expect someone to greenlight a $150 million movie because I'm funny in a room or I'm a good dinner guest.
Right.
You know, I understand all that. But, you know, I think that if I could go back in time, I would find a solution. I would try to, but it didn't happen.
What would that be?
I think that the idea of a dual cut is a good idea. The idea of releasing
PG-13
on one format, like IMAX, let's say, or the opposite, R for IMAX and PG, like a couple of weeks apart or a few weeks apart, something like that. But, you know, it's a speculation.
So do we think that Mountains of Madness comes back or we don't know yet?
You know, I know I'm going to sound glib, but that's above my pay rate. Those decisions do not rest in the hands of filmmakers. It's the dichotomy and the paradox of this business that is show business. I'm in the show part of the term, and I do my best on that part. But the other part, I find that the more you play it, the more dangerous it gets for you as a storyteller. It sort of taints the water a little bit. Like, I very comfortably right now, if I had the screenplay to do it, I would go back and do a $10 million movie like Pants or Devil's Backbone easily. I've done it in the past.
I would think you might almost prefer it because the anxiety diminishes.
Well, it's different anxiety. Actually, yeah. Pan's Labyrinth was hugely one of the worst anxiety movies I've ever shot. I was in hell because we had no budget. We had some people that didn't want the movie to happen at the time. It was very difficult to finance it when you pitch it. Now it sounds brilliant, right? But when you were pitching it, I'm doing a fairy tale in the time of fascist Spain. And the girl, spoiler,
yeah,
the girl dies
at the happens.
End.
Yeah.
So it was really, trust me, I saw everyone and nobody wanted to finance it.
You know, you have this very fecund imagination and you seem to say that you can take that anxiety and just kind of will it away.
To a point. Again, I go steady, and then huge acute episode of anxiety. And I do... I'm a warrior.
Yeah.
Well, the technique is just, can you do something about it? And if you can, I worry, and then I find what I need to do about it, and I deal with it really quick. But if I cannot do anything about it, I got to find peace. Now, some nights, I get very little sleep. When I'm shooting, I'm waking up, I'm sleeping 3 hours when I'm shooting, you know. But... you know, the older you get, I find that you manage it differently. I was much more anxious when I was young. At the end of the day, there's an assurance that comes from knowing yourself. That only happens with age.
After a short break, Guillermo del Toro talks about where he sees the business heading. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're revisiting our conversation with filmmaker Guillermo del Toro, which first aired last summer as his huge robot apocalypse movie, Pacific Rim, was hitting theaters. Next month, del Toro will premiere a new FX vampire horror series, The Strain, based on a trilogy of books that he co-wrote. He's also executive producing Kung Fu Panda 3 for DreamWorks Animation. And he's co-owner of the digital company Mirada, which produces commercials, films, and other content. Mirada created the found footage sequence at the beginning of Pacific Rim. And it's in the convergence of all of this that Guillermo del Toro sees the future of the business.
What I know I can tell you as a storyteller, I think that we are coming to a very interesting fusion of the storytelling, and the business is going to accommodate that. The relationship people have with media is at the same time more intimate and more ephemeris, you know? But we are now being guided to a different route by the what I call is the monoconsole, a little device that is a reality already in several platforms where you're going to have at home the possibility to download a movie, to browse the internet, to tape your cable and play games. All of that in one console for us is cutting edge. For the next generation growing up is normalcy. And that's where the change is going to occur. And I assure you, I don't think none of us knows where it's going to go.
Right.
But it's going to be that monoconsole that is going to change storytelling. And we have to be mindful of all that media. And that's why in the last 3-4 years, I started an apprenticeship for myself to go into TV, to go into writing novels, to go into designing video games. Because as a storyteller, I just say I better know, not only as a user, I want to know this. Constructing it. I started 4 years ago at DreamWorks to completely immerse myself in animation, because I think that's part of the change also. So I'm curious, but I don't speculate much in terms of the business.
Let me just touch on DreamWorks, because that is another setback. That was Rise of the Guardians. That was a tough loss for DreamWorks Animation. Was there a lesson from that?
I think that we have a movie that was, I think it was, if not the highest, one of the highest scoring movies in the testing at DreamWorks. We were all coming from that information. I think that the message of the movie and it connecting with the audience is what was missing. Now, ironically, the movie has become huge on the home video market. You know, now it's huge on DVD, huge on downloads, and it found its audience. And the only consolation I can have that is not just ephemeral is the movies find their audience.
I mean, there's been some discussion in the past that, you know, you have all sorts of projects that you're doing simultaneously. And I have to admit, reading, I got dizzy trying to sort them out.
Well, sadly, the story of that list of projects is more projects that have been developed to a point and have not fructified. You know? I have written or co-written approximately 23 screenplays. I've done only 8 movies, so that gives you the rate. And anyone that has ever written a screenplay know what that entitles.
Right.
The effort, the sweat, the long months.
So even Guillermo del Toro has the kind of batting average.
Oh, for sure.
Right.
No. People look at a career from the outside and think there is some plan. When you experience a career, it's literally like a very, very slow motion car crash. And you are now going towards the steering wheel, you're now breaking your teeth, you're bouncing back, you don't break your neck because you hit the headrest, and that's one movie, and that's another one, and you're experiencing them inside the car tumbling, and from the outside, you have commentators that comment on that.
Look, on that
look, oh my God, he just broke his teeth again. Couldn't he have moved to the left? What was he thinking?
Right.
You know,
I'm feeling guilty right now,
no,
but go ahead.
No, it is that. And I think that you can learn so much more from failure than from success. And I think experience, and as you grow older, you realize that. So I'm not saying you welcome failure, but you do welcome adversity to a point, you know. And you know that success always is very easy to learn the wrong lesson from success. Super easy. And no one in our culture prepares you for that. Everybody tells you how to deal with failure. Nobody says you need management to deal with success properly, because it's seen as a cure-all of, or the end-all of end-all.
Can you give us an example of a lesson you learned from success that was bad, or a lesson from failure that was really good?
You know, I can tell you that I never made Pan's Labyrinth to be nominated for Academy Awards. That happened, but I didn't do it for that. But if at the beginning of my life, when I did Kronos, first movie, it won the Grand Prix of the Critics Week at Cannes.
Yeah.
If I had at that point said, oh, I'm going to make my movies to continue winning awards, they probably would have eluded me, or they probably would have never happened, or happened the wrong way. I'll give you another example. There's a movie called Mimic, which was incredibly difficult for me to do. And I learned a fantastic word from that failure and that pain, a word that is vital, but I didn't know as a Mexican filmmaker, and the word is no. You know? And if it feels wrong, it's wrong. And you say no. You know? And I
no to the project?
Not to the project, or not to the idea. It doesn't matter if it's the head of the studio, an executive, a producer. If it feels that you should say no, you say no. And that was a big lesson. And the movie is not by any means a success, but I learned a lot. I think that there's a thing that is very easy to say when you haven't been tried. When somebody tells me, I don't sell out, you say, have someone tried to be bought? You know, when you have, and you have your own personal episode where you know you have a boundary, that's really good. And that often happens if you learn the right lesson from success, or if you learn the right lesson from failure either.
We have read that you have experienced lucid dreaming, what you call lucid dreaming, since you were a child. And is that something, how does that work? And it's part of the filmmaking and the creation?
Well, it stopped when I was a kid.
It stopped.
It happens now and then. It happened to me once in my 20s, and it was terrifying. What happens is you fall asleep and you wake up in the dream in the room you're in.
I have had that happen. Yeah. I did not know.
So you're still asleep. You're in a dream, but you don't think you're in a dream.
Right.
And things happen, and you experience things that look real. And when I was a kid, I used to see monsters. I used to see a fawn coming from behind the armoire in front of my bed. I used to see things in the. My parents had this 1960s shaggy carpet that was green. Imagine that, very 60s.
Yeah.
And I used to see the shaggy strands move like fingers.
Oh.
And I knew that if I stepped on them, they would grab me and sink me, pull me down somewhere. And then I would wake up. And the last time I had that lucid dream was when I had just married my wife, like about 6 months into the marriage. I dreamt I was in bed and there was a fire, and I sensed the fire through my closed eyes, and I woke up and I saw a burning man sitting down in the sofa across from me, and the guy got up and walked towards me with his arms extended and said, "I live." And I woke up screaming. You know, but it's fortunately not something I experience anymore. But it is a very powerful experience.
Does it feed into the monster creation?
No, you know, my dreams are daydreams. Mm. I have an incredibly active imagination. That's for good, for the creation. But if my wife is an hour late, I imagine all kinds of paranoid scenarios. You know?
Yeah.
You know, so it's not good for daily life, but it's great at inventing stories.
Guillermo del Toro is a filmmaker. His latest movie is Pacific Rim. Thank you so much for coming in.
A pleasure.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps, and you can hear the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.